Support for the Front Porch comes from WVCarFinder.com, matching West Virginia cars with West Virginians who want to buy them. It's a service of the Charleston Gazette-Mail. More at WVCarFinder.com. And you're on the Front Porch. I'm Rick Wilson with the American Friends Service Committee, filling in for Scott Finn, who is at an undisclosed location right now. We can't reveal that. And with me, as always, is my conservative counterpart, Lori Lynn, writer, attorney, Twitter demon, and I mean that as a compliment, Lori. And I should say, we talk about issues often from different points of view. Lori and I actually do agree on a few things, but we don't like to talk about it since it would ruin both of our reputations.
Exactly.
How are you doing this week,
Lori?
I'm
well. How are you, Rick?
I think okay. And it's been kind of a horrendous week in the news. And with us this time is Vice President David Friesen, who is in charge of the Division of Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion at West Virginia University. And we're going to talk about some of the events of the week. We're going to continue having that difficult conversation about race, which we seem to usually pick up, as Dr. Friesen says, at the worst possible times. How are you doing, Dr. Friesen?
I'm doing well, thank you. I'm very glad to be here to have this very difficult conversation, but a very needed one.
So as we get started, can you start by talking a little bit about your work with WVU and what the Division of Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion tries to do in the university and beyond?
Yes. Well, it's indicative of the name, actually, is that we are a division that has been tasked with making sure that West Virginia University, as well as the state of West Virginia, is open to diversity, open to inclusion, and that we make sure that we have a platform. We deal with things such as affirmative action, but we also deal with things such as Title IX to make sure that the campus and the institution is a safe place, it's a welcoming place, and it is an inclusive place.
So it's been a pretty horrendous week in the news with the shootings by police officers of Anton Sterling, Philando Castile, and then, again, the killing of five police officers in Dallas, Texas. And there's been news around the state about tensions. I think last week would have been a good time to take a vacation from social media as well, with all the stuff being kicked around. What are your immediate thoughts about this, and how can we have the kind of conversations we need to have?
Well, my thoughts are is that we continue to have a lot of work to do in the United States in the area of race relations. But at the same time, I don't want to, as the president has suggested, I don't want to in any way diminish the great strides that we have made over the years. This is not 1957. It's not 1896. It's not even 1968. And for us to act as if that there has been no progress would be a mistake, while at the same time we have to admit that there are these areas of the lack of inclusion. There are these areas of how race intersects with privilege in our country that we need to continue to open our dialogue and open our space so that we can be an ever more unified and open society.
I want to ask about the conversation about the conversation, because you do hear this phrase come up over and over, you know, we need to have a conversation. And I start to wonder, you know, the 10th time that I hear that, what are we not saying that needs to be said in this conversation? What am I not saying as a white person? You know, what are you not saying as a black person? Are there undercurrents that we just keep sort of dancing around? Or we do seem to say this every single time this happens, we need to have a conversation.
Well, actually, I think we have a lot of conversation about having the conversation. And I challenge us to whether or not we truly have the conversations, particularly, though, the conversations in a way where we aren't reacting to an event. Because it seems that we have these moments. And then when the moment passes, we act as if that we go back to our normal daily kind of interactions. And I believe our challenge is to have difficult conversations in safe spaces. In other words, that we need to be able to have the difficult conversations where we aren't using gotcha moments, but so that we can really educate the public, where we can really see from the different sides. It is pretty amazing sometimes in some of the interactions that I have, that many people just have never really thought the issues through. And unfortunately, in this day of reality television and 24-hour news, you can kind of pick and choose what you want to hear. So many times people from the right or from the left will choose their venues, and we have lost our ability to talk to one another in the middle.
What's the role of the media and social media in all of this? On the one hand, our attention is being drawn to things that otherwise, you know, may have been missed before in terms of these, the disparate treatment by police of Black people. But on the other hand, it also fans the flames, you know, sends people even deeper into their own tribalism. I'm thinking in particular of the night in Ferguson that the police officer, they decided they weren't going to indict him. And there was almost this feeling, you know, if you turned on cable news, they were so excited. Oh, my goodness, there are going to be riots, you know, almost egging people on. So it seems in some ways it's a positive and in some ways it's a negative.
Well, I think we should look at it really in two ways and maybe separate the difference from the media and from social media. The idea of the social media has been a benefit in many ways because it allows many times unheard voices to be heard. And I think that's very important. I think the social media world has allowed us to see in real time events that happen. I mean, the advent of the cell phone cameras has allowed us to see many, many of these incidents that would not have really made it to the public sphere. To me, that's the upside of social media. The downside of social media is that there's no filter. There's no editor. And so what you have can go out to an audience without any real contemplation of the effect of that statement of or what is going on. At the same time, I believe that I don't know how well we are being served by the proliferation of media. It has become this thing that media, rather than reporting events, many times are part of the event and causes the events. So it seems as though that in order to fill 24/7 space, that we have to be continually more provocative in our conversations and in our reactions, so that the media has become almost like a part of the so-called reality world, which in truth, I don't believe there's much true reality in that world.
Yeah, I think it's sort of a postmodern thing where images of things are more important than things themselves. I'd like to talk a little bit about, you know, when we talk about race and racism, I think one thing that holds us back is we often, especially probably white people, think about it in terms of personal stuff. Like, I personally am not a racist. I'm not this or that. Instead of looking at the structural, the institutional aspects, the systematic inequalities of wealth, assets, income, how people are treated in the criminal justice system, contacts with the police and all that. And so I think at some point we need to start looking, not just having the conversation, but look at what the reality is out there.
Yeah, I would agree with that. The other thing I don't think that we give enough time to understand is that we all look through events through a cultural filter. And many times our cultural filter is so strong that we fail to realize there may be another way to look at the same facts. For instance, those that are proponents of the Black Lives Matter movement, many times when that statement is made, Black Lives Matter, it is actually made through a cultural filter that says Black Lives Matter too, or Black Lives Matter also, because it is, of course, all lives matter. But we aren't talking about all lives. We're talking about this idea of how certain interactions within the Black community have historically inured to the detriment, particularly of Black men. While at the same time, someone who was against that phraseology, Black Lives Matter, they hear that as saying Black Lives Matter only. And so the rebuff through that cultural lens is, well, why isn't it Blue Lives Matter or White Lives Matter or All Lives Matter? And so having a recognition that we hear the same words, but we process it through a cultural lens, causes us many times to unfortunately disagree on things that we really could have more agreement on if we would spend the time to understand our own cultural lens and the cultural lens of other people.
One thing I think is important to keep in mind in this is, like, when I get pulled over by the police while driving, I don't usually think about getting killed. I mean, if I do, I'd have to really work at it if I did, you know, and it's a whole different thing for, you know, especially young men of color. And that's something I think a lot of us need to think about. There's just a whole bunch of things you don't have to worry about if you're not in that situation. And that the police contact does seem to be a flashpoint. How do you think we can get beyond that?
And to me, that's part of this needed conversation, because I believe when people hear the felt needs, the actual stories, such as someone such as myself, you know, at my age, if I am stopped by the police, there is a level of true nervousness, and I can have on a coat and tie. But yet, through interactions in the past, I know that I can't make any quick moves, or there are things that I have to do. And those are the kind of felt experiences that if you haven't lived it, you need to at least trust the felt experiences of other people. And that's why the question was asked earlier, what about this conversation? That is the level of the conversation that I think that we need to have. Not just to continue to have, you know, the race conversation, but how the felt life experiences are. I have two young sons that are in their 30s. And Thursday evening, when this was all going on, the conversation with them was about all of the different interactions that they have had. My oldest son just graduated from law school, but yet he has been stopped multiple times because of the kind of car he drives. Those are not made up experiences. Those are true experiences where when the truth of the matter is that there was really literally no probable cause for the stop. And so I think it's important for us to have the conversation. I also think it's important for us to understand that you know, within the African-American community, there's not an anti-police. I mean, we need the police. And so you can be a proponent of Black Lives Matter, but also be strongly supportive of police, particularly those police who are doing the right thing, and be supportive of that. I have represented as an attorney two municipalities in West Virginia where I represented the police force, and I understand the stress that they are under. But again, because we don't have those conversations, and so an ongoing conversation might be, you know, with a young African-American and a white police officer, to have that as a dialogue for third parties to be able to hear, maybe the fear of the police officer when he makes the stop, to hear the fear of perhaps the young African-American who has done nothing. But the interesting thing about what fear does, it makes you act in ways that you wouldn't act otherwise, and that inures to the detriment of the potential relationship.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point. I mean, I think if you look at the way that police are trained to think about their safety and to perceive everyone as a potential threat, but the reality is that, you know, if they pull me over, a white suburban mom in my minivan, they're much less likely to perceive me as a threat, and probably too likely to perceive somebody who looks different as a threat. How can we, because that's not in their training, they're presumably not taught, you know, you should fear people who look one way more than other people. How do we address that? Because that we're talking about things that are part of their past, their backgrounds. You know, it's a cultural stereotype that isn't easily dislodged. If you could be part of police training, what would you tell a new police officer about, you know, you pull over a Black man, what should be in his mind?
Well, I think it goes into a whole training module, and I do think training is part of that. The whole idea of how we all have unconscious bias and how that bias makes us react. I have been involved in diversity training back in the 90s with some police units, and I found it to be a very difficult sale. And the interesting thing about it is that can be beyond just race, because it really can be a blue line where the officers can be black or white, but yet see it from a perspective. So I do believe that training is important. I believe that training could only be a start, and I think it needs to be ongoing. I actually don't like the word. I don't like the phrase diversity training, because I think we need to have these diversity conversations, and it needs to be ongoing. Last year when I was on right after the tragic shootings in Charleston, South Carolina, we talked about the fact that we needed to have these conversations on an ongoing basis, but yet we haven't met again until we now have a situation where we're at crisis. And somehow we have to be able to have these interactions at a time when it's not in a crisis, so that we can maybe let our defenses down. But I do believe that training is part of that, interactions on an ongoing basis. I believe in community policing, that it is important for the community to know the police that are there. If not, then it seems like an occupying force rather than the empowerment that a police force can bring to a community.
Back in the 90s, I, too, was involved in some diversity things for the police. That was before I knew how to say no very well. And it was a really challenging gig. I think one thing we did was sort of a focus group where we talked to some young African-American people in the community, then asked the officers the same questions, and it was kind of a compare and contrast. But one thing that I remember that came out of those conversations is the most effective protection that a police officer has is being seen as a legitimate authority in the community, which is what you're saying about being a part of the community, having relationships with people, being seen as someone who doesn't use excessive force, who treats people with respect.
Yeah, it's interesting, because when you use a term like authority, authority comes with certain responsibilities. And it's not enough to just have the arm of the government behind you, but you also have to have the respect of those that you're dealing with. And respect is something that's built over a period of time. And so it is important that we have interactions in communities with police that are beyond just the crime prevention or just the crime reaction, that those interactions are on an ongoing basis. One of the things that we do at West Virginia University, at the beginning of the year, we have a mixer with some of our students from diverse backgrounds with our university police. And we start that so that the police are not just nameless, faceless, but they're actually humans. We start that interaction at the very beginning. And I think that those are the type of community policing things that would be so very important on an ongoing basis, so it doesn't seem as though that the police are an occupying force, but they're there to help.
Another area, a focal point that we need to have conversations about is, you know, I would think about this as a parent, is how to survive that initial encounter. You know, the initial encounter, say, of a young African-American person with the police, or a police officer with someone that they're detaining or stopping or questioning, is like that encounter itself is fraught probably with danger and fear on both sides, and just looking at ways of de-escalating and, you know, getting across to people in the community that you're not going to be able to fix a problem right then and there. If there is a problem, you need to get through that situation, that real moment of tension, I guess.
Yeah, but again, that even goes into how that different communities are policed differently. I mean, just when you think about the idea of that we have to make the statement, legitimately so, how do you survive the initial encounter? I mean, that in and of itself to me is just filled with the pressure of our history. So that if I'm stopped for speeding, or if I'm stopped for running a stop sign, what has to go through a mind of a person of color is, how do I survive this? As opposed to the normal nervousness that anyone would have about getting a ticket. And so, again, it just shows you how the difficulty that we have to unravel, because we're not just unraveling today. We're unraveling our long history in this country. And as you said, and I think rightfully so, there are times for certain conversations, and a conversation to unravel the history may not be at a police stop. every black parent has that conversation with their children, but I think every police sergeant needs to have that conversation with their police officer as well.
Dr. Friesen, speaking of our country's history, I'll admit, in the 2008 election, I did not vote for Obama. I didn't vote for him in 2012 either. I actually was working for the McCain campaign in Ohio, and I remember really vividly the next morning, the morning after the election, I was getting on a plane in Columbus to go home. And, you know, I'm tired and I'm depressed. But I had this thought in my mind, you know, our guy lost. It's a bummer. But one thing that I thought was a real positive was, you know, this country has elected a black president for the first time in its history, a century and a half after slavery. Surely this is going to be a really good thing for race relations in America. And I think a lot of people felt that way. 8 years later doesn't feel that way. And I'm not blaming the president, but are you yourself surprised that it almost seems like we're in a worse place than we were 8 years ago? Is it just a coincidence? You know, when you look at the fact that we have a black president, yet we still have all this division, how do you make sense of that?
Well, I challenge the premise on a couple of levels. I don't know if we're necessarily in a worse place. I actually think that we're in a revealed place, because I believe that what the election in 2008 did was take the hopefulness of that moment, even though people such as yourself might have, you know, felt that it was something to mourn, but the hopefulness of that moment revealed the true nature of who we were. Because if you remember, President Obama, in his first State of the Union address, Representative Wilson stood up and called him a liar, breaking all protocol. So what we have here is the treatment of the first African-American president that kind of pulled back the scab that really revealed where we really were. And we weren't as far as we thought that we were. The interesting thing about a presidential election, you know, if you can win with 52% or 53% of the vote, you can even win with 60% of the vote. But that doesn't mean that the 40% that did not vote will come on board. And I think that was the challenge that we had, that at a time, rather than cooperating with the new president, it immediately went in some quarters, in some conservative quarters, went into defense mode, where we were trying to make it a failed presidency from day one. And yes, there is some response to that. Yes, there is some challenge to that. I don't necessarily believe we're in a worse place. I think we're in a revealed place.
It occurs to me that there's the term driving while black. There's also governing while black, which seems to really offend a lot of people out there. I want to talk a little bit about sort of dog whistle politics, which is a term I'm sure you're familiar with. It's sort of the use of not overt, but sort of coded racial appeals to generate political power. You want to comment on that, how that's working these days?
Well, to be quite frank, I think we're so far away from dog whistle politics. I think we have sirens going off.
Yeah, I think you're right.
You know, at one point, but I actually think that your point is very good, because what we've had since almost the Southern strategy in the late 60s and the 70s, we've had this political separation. And it was done many times with a wink and a nod. It was done with where you start off your political campaign, Philadelphia, Mississippi, for example. It was done with this whole idea of the coded language. But what has happened with the coded language, it has taken such a momentum that now we don't even have coded language. We actually have just overt. We have overt language now that in the past would have ended political careers. And so when people say, well, are things worse now than they were? Yep, in some ways, in terms of our ability in the public sphere to say things that are negative, now we may be in a worse place. And we do that in the name of being against political correctness, when in fact, to me, it's not political correctness, it's just politeness and true true ability to be respectful in the public sphere. And we have lost so much of that, and we've lost that to our detriment.
But just to be clear, are you saying that when the gentleman stood up and said, "You lie," I don't remember who that was.
It was Wilson.
That was an act of racism because the president he was saying it to was black?
Yeah, let me ask you a question. Can you give me a time when that has ever happened in our history?
You mean a person challenging a president on the floor of Congress?
During the State of the Union address, yes.
No, but I mean, I would counter with, you know, for example, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, that has created a controversy this week by being, you know, the first sitting Supreme Court justice to inject herself into a presidential race and, you know, comment very strongly about Donald Trump. I mean, I would attribute that to the breakdown of civility in society and politics generally. I mean, there's no racial element there.
Well, let me go back to the original question that I asked you, is that because we're shape-shifting. Because I asked you the question, had there ever been a time during the State of the Union address when a president was accosted like that? And again, it's not like that there was some long history of him being president. This was his first address. And your question was no, but. And my suggestion to you that when we start adding buts to no, then we're missing the point.
Yeah, I mean, I would just say I understand your point, but I would also say from the other side, there's a little bit of an off-putting aspect to, if I criticize the president, it is very possible that I am actually just criticizing the president. And I think, you know, when there's a tendency to say, oh, well, you know, you just don't like the black guy, you know, really? I think that has a bit of a corrosive aspect to our dialogue as well.
The problem with your statement is that you're setting up a straw man, because that's just not true. I mean, we deal on a daily basis with the criticism of the president. No one is suggesting that every criticism of this president is based on race. But there has been a level of disrespect. And the reason I use that as an example, that started at the very beginning. And because of that, I mean, it would be one thing if this were some long-term policy issue. But no, this was at the beginning. And I use that as an example. Just as an example, because remember, the original premise was that we have a black president, it seems like things are worse. And all I'm saying is, no, I'm not saying things are worse. I'm just saying things have been revealed to the depth of the depravity of where we have been. But to be quite frank, I think it can be useful because so much of it was hidden before. Just very quickly, Dr. Martin Luther King made a statement that I think is profound, because he said that we talk about the need for peace, right? But he says that there's two kind of peace. There's one peace, which he calls a negative peace, which is the absence of tension. But he called a positive peace, which is the presence of justice. And so I'm not saying that there needs to be a complete absence of tension, not at all. But I think that what we need to be doing is pushing toward this idea of where is the justness at the end of the day.
And I think I think we are on the same page here. We also need to look at the structural inequalities that are out there that affect everybody's life chances.
Absolutely.
Dr. Friesen, feel free not to answer this question, but you mentioned that you had sons who were in their 30s, so I feel comfortable asking you, are you old enough to remember 1968? Can you talk maybe a little bit about how this year is different? Because there have been a lot of comparisons made to that really tumultuous year.
So was that a sly way of asking me how old I am?
Well, we haven't met in person, so I wouldn't have assumed that you remembered it. But you did mention that you had sons who were in their 30s. So
no, in 1968, the year that Robert Kennedy was killed, Martin Luther King was killed, I think I was 14 years old.
So you probably don't remember it very vividly, or you were at least young enough to remember it, but maybe not enough, not an adult, certainly.
No, I remember it vividly, to be quite frank. And to be quite frank, that's one of the things about growing up as a person of color in America there are many times that the innocence of childhood is taken away because you have to deal with those things. I was 14 when Dr. King was killed, or in 1968. But up to that time, you know, living in southern West Virginia, you know, I would, as a small kid at 8 years old, I can remember riding my bike down the road, and people in cars, normally those cars would have Confederate flags on them, to be quite frank, throwing bottles at me. And I would just be confused as to why this anger, or yet be called the N-word. So, yes, my memories of those days are extremely strong.
But you said this is not as bad. Why is this not as bad? Because we've come farther as a country?
Well, just in terms of what you consider what was going on in terms of the marginalization of the black community, when you see that voting rights were marginalized, when you see in the South, my father, by the way, and I jumped generations because I was born in 1954, but yet my father was 58 when I was born. He was born in 1896. And he had been reared by a slave. So I jumped generations in terms of my relationships there. So to talk to my father, who was born in 1896, the year of Plessy versus Ferguson, and to see that the reason that he left Alabama in the 1920s was because he was going to be hung, that puts a different perspective. To see in the late 1950s into the early 60s that, you know, you had Emmett Till in the late 50s. And as a little boy, I remember reading those Jet magazines where he was beaten and killed, where you see the shootings and the marginalizations. So, yeah, I can speak from that standpoint that absolutely that we're in a different place. You know, I sit as a vice president at a predominantly white institution in 1968. That would not have happened.
I agree. I think we are in a different space, in new ground.
How well do you remember 1968, Rick?
I do remember 1968. I remember the Poor People's March on Washington. I remember, you know, watching some of the events on TV, the Vietnam War. 1 year later, I was really disappointed there weren't space monsters on the moon when they landed there. But
Dr. Friesen, is there anything else that you would like to talk about?
Not really. I mean, I think that we've covered a lot of ground here. But the one thing that I do think that is important, and I don't care if you're on the right or the left, that we all have to be involved in problem solving going forward, and not just not just to get over the moment, but the fact that while there have been great successes, we've come a very long way. But there is work to do, and we should take the work that needs to be done as being exciting. Because it's not over, but we're part of this grand continuum that started with slavery and has now ended, that now continues to more perfect our union. And I actually think that we can use these days of difficulties as a positive, that yeah, that we aren't just sitting on our laurels, but now we're going into the depths of the difficulties in challenged communities, so that we truly can say that we are the land of the free.
So, Rick, do you have a Bible verse for us this week?
In fact, I do. First of all, let me just say the word apocalypse means uncovering of something that's already there. So I think Dr. Friesen has talked about uncovering. But the verse that comes to mind is, "Be not overcome with evil, but overcome evil with good." That's from Romans, and that's our task out there.
And I would just add Romans 8:28 that says, "All things work together for good to them that love God and are called according to his purpose." And so if we truly are called, we can see this as working toward a good, a greater good in the long run.
Thank you, Vice President Friesen, for being here. Thanks, Lori.
Sure thing.
And we'll see you next week on the Front Porch.